Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Medicine, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Claire Clark, one of the hosts of the channel, and today we're talking to Christopher D.E. Willoughby. Dr. Willoughby is a visiting assistant professor of the history of medicine and health at Pitzer College, and he is the author of the brand new book, Masters of Health, Racial Science and Slavery in U.S. Medical Schools, which is just out from the University of North Carolina Press. Hot off the presses. He is also the editor of the book, Medicine and Healing in the Age of Slavery. And we are just thrilled to have him on the show today. Chris, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
I wonder if you could begin our interview by telling us a little bit about yourself.
So, I started off on this project. Weirdly, I'm not going to speak too much about being an undergraduate, but the College of Charleston, and I had a mentor there, Peter McCandless, who's written about the history of psychiatric care in the South, and then wrote his last book on slavery and health. And ironically, other than just learning how to be a good historian and being a research assistant for him, I didn't actually start working on the history of medicine until graduate school at Tulane University. But at College of Charleston, I started looking at racial science texts and started really thinking deeply about why is racial science so compelling? What did it mean to Southerners and pro-slavery advocates? And then my graduate training made me start thinking a little bit more nationally about it. So at Tulane, I started working on the history of medicine component as well. My advisor, Randy, is a transnational historian of slavery. So that very much has shaped my approach. But on the other hand, we in some ways couldn't be more different. He's a social historian of everyday people in the enslaved societies, whereas a lot of this book focuses on elite white physicians and their racial constructs. But at Tulane, I got the tools to be a good transnational historian. And it's also where I met another mentor, and reminder that their mentors often are not always just in your graduate program, but that's Deirdre Cooper Owens. And she and I started working together fairly early in grad school, and she was on my dissertation committee and really helped me start seeing this story of medicine, racial science, and slavery as a national phenomena, where physicians in New York, like people she studied, J. Marion Sims, who lives in both the South and in New York, conducted racist experiments on people. And so that foundation of looking at Southern history, the history of racism, as both a national issue and an issue that affects medical institutions, that is something I started to really develop in grad school and with two really important mentors and my advisor, Randy Sparks and Deirdre Cooper Owens.
Well, what a wonderful mentorship team. Tell us about Masters of Health. Tell us about this book. How did you come to write it?
Well, it, like so many other first academic books, it does start as a dissertation. That was a pretty narrow history of racial science in medical schools from 1820 to 1860. And what what I think was successful about the dissertation was this national orientation. But I also found that I really wanted to write a more expansive project. So early on when I was doing research for the book and for the dissertation, I found these medical student dissertations on the subject of polygenesis. And it's such a, to me, a critical point, and a point that I try and draw out throughout the book, is that racial science was not just being written about or taught about by the most elite physicians, or just by kind of pro-slavery, we might say, yahoos like a John C. Calhoun, who is really just the, you know, the most legitimate of a much weirder tier of people underneath him. So I was very interested in, what did the average medical student think about race? How can we get at that question? So medical student theses and medical dissertations were a really critical step in mapping out what is and what was a very well entrenched by the end of the period I study. So that's 1765 to 1860, roughly. A very well entrenched racial curriculum in medical schools that develops, particularly the development of it accelerates in the antebellum era, but goes back to the founding of the first medical school. So these dissertations tell us that medical students were interested in how to treat enslaved people, the effects of the environment on enslaved people or people of African descent's bodies, and finally, their perception that people of African descent had anatomically distinct bodies. And what we also see is that this was not just the kind of fantasies of a 20-year-old. I mean, they are fantasies, but that these were a deep entrenched part of the medical curriculum. And then finally, in the book, from dissertation to book, I also really emphasized the role of medical museums in drawing in an international array of human remains to create racial skull collections in medical schools that students could then measure themselves, practice racial science on themselves, and also, in a strange way, attach the students to a much more international set of racial concerns. So as I said, the dissertation very much oriented towards a national story in a fairly short time period. And in the book, I really tried to expand out to think about how American slavery, American racial science, both has origins well into the 18th century and does not just kind of appear during the pro-slavery, active pro-slavery era of the 1830s, 40s, and 50s. But also that as the U.S. was becoming a more internationally engaged country in its kind of development, it also, students were connecting with and using human remains to study race, or what they perceived as racial differences around the world.
We're going to dig into some of these sources in a little bit more detail. I really want to hear about these MD theses and human remains and medical schools, skull collections and museums. You get into some pretty disturbing stuff. But before we do that, I wondered if we could just kind of zoom out a little bit and you could give us a concise discussion of the overall argument of the book. So what's the take-home message of Masters of Health?
Sure. So The biggest, you know, if we're going to put the kind of flashing lights above the entrance to my disturbing book, it would be racial thinking underwrote the rise of the medical profession in the United States. And what do I mean by that? So a critical aspect of American medical education, American medical schools, is they develop and start developing right at the beginning of the international abolition movement. In 1765, when Benjamin Rush, the University of Pennsylvania professor, Declaration of Independence signer, when he's promoting abolition and thinking about race in the 1760s and 1770s, it really is possible to see an end of slavery. The kind of cotton boom in the 1790s after the invention of the cotton gin will change that, and slavery will, of course, re-expand. But during that initial period, a major discourse over abolition emerges. And So there is a debate over slavery for the next century as medical schools begin to emerge and proliferate across the United States. Now, the other side of this is that the medical profession is in a distinct period of crisis and competition during this period. They are trying to establish legitimacy while competing with homeopaths, osteopaths, we might think of everyday healers, as well as people advocating for self-healing. So having an expertise on race in a society kind of in the process for 50, 60 years of various times tearing itself apart and bringing itself back together over the question of slavery and the underlying premise of kind of structure of white supremacy that justifies slavery, this is a very powerful tool. And it really helps schools like the University of Pennsylvania, the first medical school, become the dominant school in medical education for much of the first 100 years of American medical education and even beyond. So why is this? Well, the University of Pennsylvania has the largest student bodies. By the 1850s, that's over 400 students some years. These student bodies are all half Southern, half Northern. So it brings together and creates a national medical profession, even as the United States is nationally in a state of rupture. So you'd see Southern booster Southern booster doctors claiming that Northern medical schools don't teach racial difference. And then Southern medical alumni would say, there's nothing further from the truth. So what I show is that racial thinking was a critical piece in creating a nationally cohesive medical profession in a time period where the United States was not nationally cohesive. And that medical profession will survive the Civil War and continue to grow today, even as, thankfully there have been some reforms, but still much work to be done on the issue of racism in medicine.
Well, give us a little overview of the book, because it's got a three-part structure. So what do each of the three sections deal with?
So the first part of the book really tracks the emergence of two things. And that's the first, the dominance of the theory of polygenesis, which we're going to get into a little bit later. Mm-hmm. But that is basically this idea that each human race, quote unquote, race is obviously a scientifically flawed, if not discredited, concept, but each human race is a distinct species created for distinct climates and environments. And this for, much of the previous, we'll say, almost 2,000 years of the history of Christendom was a heretical belief compared to the belief that all humans derive from Adam and Eve, or basically monogenesis. And then the second key feature is the rise of the medical school. For the first, much of the colonial era of the Americas, all medical training was done by apprenticeships. Therefore, students were had a very idiosyncratic set of beliefs. So once in the medical school, teaching a racial science-oriented version of the body of human difference allows for, I argue in part one, for mass proliferation of ideas about racial difference and the promotion of this way of seeing racial difference I call the clinical racial gaze, or the kind of confluence of anatomical ways of seeing the body and racial ways, or the slaveholder's way of seeing the body, of analyzing a body for whipping scars to see if someone has misbehaved or is an unruly enslaved person. This can intersect in disturbing ways with cutting open a body to see pathology or gross anatomy, the kind of literal geography of the interns of the body. And then part two examines how this education was disturbingly practical, disturbingly hands-on. So I look at the rise of body snatching and how, particularly in the South, enslaved people were the core constituency to have their bodies stolen to be dissection material. And in the North, Black people were disproportionately had their bodies stolen and dissected by medical students. I also unpack cases of experiments on live subjects that were done by medical students. And these were in some ways quite different from what we might think of as, you know, therapeutic surgical experimentation. These had no therapeutic value, but rather risked the life of enslaved people but did not in any way try to save them or repair their bodies. So in one case, I look at a woman who had tobacco rubbed all over her body, and to induce tobacco toxicity or nicotine toxicity, and then was forced to breastfeed a child to the point to where the infant nearly died. And so the student, though, was not failed. They were not banned from medical school, but rather they graduated and moved on with their life and practiced. And then finally, I look at the different ways that anatomy was taught, racial differences, anatomical differences were taught from medical lectures first, medical textbooks first, and then faculty did elaborate lectures about racial difference with visual aids, passing around human remains. And then third, students could then go into those medical museums themselves, measure skulls for themselves. And fourth, students might write about racial difference and anatomical difference in their theses. So part two really shows that this kind of white supremacist medicine was not just learned in a rote fashion, but was also learned through the actions and everyday behavior of medical students and the pedagogy in the medical school. And then finally, part three is where we really look at the medical school as a part of the American medical school as a part of a increasingly globalizing society. So first, I examine how imperialism enabled the creation of these global skull collections, connecting students to locales around the world with body parts coming from West Africa, South Asia, South America, in some cases, you know, the heads of mummies stolen from Egyptian tombs. But it helps students develop an outlook where they compare the racial paradigms, be it Native American extermination or enslavement in the South, to European imperialism around the world and the racial constructs that European imperialists are creating during this time period. And additionally, and elsewhere, kind of building on this theme, I look at how data from imperial locations, particularly about mortality data to certain diseases that are broken up by race, was used to think about how the U.S. should potentially create first internally, one might think of it, racial public health laws to either keep slavery in the South or prevent free people of color from entering into northern states. The idea being from these racist doctors, of course, that northern cold climates would first potentially cause enslaved people to go insane. This was a belief that was perpetuated by the since discredited census of 1840 that showed higher rates of mania, as would have been the term at the time, among Black people in the North. But that was discredited in its own time, but doctors continued to restate that. And then also that the health concerns, be they pneumonia, tuberculosis, that Black people's bodies were more poorly adapted to health in the North. And so on the one hand, this environmental data and comparative data essentially justifies slavery as a public health, a racial public health program. And then second, physicians began to use this international data to think about whether or not the U.S. should become an expansive overseas empire itself. And then finally, another critical theme in part three are counter-narratives of individual people who were racialized by 19th century physicians. So in one case, I discuss the kind of story of an enslaved Brazilian rebel whose skull ends up at Harvard's medical school. And he's a participant, potentially a street-level leader in the 1835 Malay Revolt or Muslim Uprising in Bahia, one of the largest slave revolts in Brazilian history. So part three really takes the national story of everyday training and the emergence of the medical school that's in part one and part two, and shows how these ideologies are shaped by a increasingly international and even global set of forces and ideas about race, and that then American racial science is also being applied to think about American foreign policy, what it means to be a white supremacist nation in a global, increasingly globally interconnected society.
So this stuff is really disturbing reading. I have to tell our listeners it's difficult stuff to process, and I imagine that it was really difficult. It was difficult to research as well. The evidence base that you marshal here is so impressive. You draw on a wealth of primary sources, institutional archives, museums, published scientific literature, correspondence, teaching materials, lecture notes, and these MD theses that you mentioned, which I imagine are very challenging reading. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about what it was like excavating and processing this difficult material over the period of so many years. So this is your dissertation and then became a book. You've been living with this history for a while.
Yeah, my first trip into the archives to look at MD theses was in 2011. So it's been an 11-year, more than a decade of thinking about this. And it's doing this kind of research and finding this kind of subterranean story of racist medicine. And in some ways it was subterranean, in some ways it's on the surface. It took a long time. I spent 10 months, you know, kind of 40 hours a week at the Medical University of South Carolina's Waring Historical Library and the University of Pennsylvania's Kislak Center, where the two main bodies of theses I looked at, reading these more than 4,000 dissertations. And I would describe it as, long periods of time looking through some of the most poorly written, you know, student papers you've ever read, then articulated by moments of true horror. I can remember sitting in the Waring Historical Library. It's a very small library. For some reason, I was in the second floor, which is not usually used, sitting alone, when I came across one of the most disturbing aspects of the book, which is a case where a student deliberately infects an enslaved person with malaria. And I just kind of, you know, sat there with my breath taken away, not sure what to do other than eventually start taking notes. But yeah, it's been an interesting trip because on the initially I was writing this, I think, during the Obama era, when it felt like a book about the rise of technocratic racism. And then the Trump era, the alt-right people literally started reviving these racial ideas. Some of them, you know, even citing some of the racial scientists that I discussed from the 1850s. So it then took on a different kind of horror of far to not just a kind of analog or prehistory of the problems of technocratic, we might even say liberal racism today, and to really thinking about how much these ideas, this kind of white supremacy is still profoundly, I mean, this even the skull measuring has not left American intellectual culture as much as we might wish it had. And then the second moment that really stood out was looking at museum records of the skull collection at Harvard. And what stood out to me there was, well, both, you know, starting to think more and more, the more I studied skull collections, you start realizing these are hundreds, thousands of people's lives that were ended in some way, form, or fashion, but that are often invisibilized by the presentation of them. And so starting to find stories of people and how they died, that was another really kind of difficult moment to sit with in the archive alone. And then I would say the other final thing that I think is both was so illuminating, but once again, really difficult, is early on, I started looking at, and I've always loved reading historical correspondence. You can tell a lot about people, but I think when I started reading about the history of racial science, it felt really comforting to think of it as a Southern pro-slavery movement. And correspondence mm-hmm. networks tell a very different story. They tell a story of the most elite physicians in the U.S., be they faculty at Harvard, the University of Pennsylvania, at Columbia University, at now New York University, being tightly wound with the kind of Josiah Nott, a founder of the University of Alabama at Birmingham's medical school, what is now that medical school, who is often considered much more of this kind of pro-slavery pseudoscientist. And I should say I'm using pseudoscientists in scare quotes, but that this was a truly national story that was driven as much or more from the top down, and not just by people with a direct vested economic interest in slavery.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, two of the key concepts in the story you tell are monogenesis and polygenesis. Tell us a little bit about them. What is monogenesis and what's polygenesis, and how did polygenesis shape medical education?
Yeah. So monogenesis, I know I mentioned it earlier, but these are obviously much more complicated theories, but monogenesis dates back to essentially biblical creation. And it's, you know, what the main churches, the Catholic Church, the Protestant Church, these are the enshrined idea of imbuing human history where my book focuses in the 18th and even 19th century. It also, generally speaking, monogenes then had to explain racial difference through environmental change. People's bodies were shaped by the environments they lived. Somebody like John Bachman, a pro-slavery monogenes from South Carolina in the 1840s and 1850s, and a reverend, we should note, and a collaborator of John James Audubon, he argued that racial difference was not caused by biblical creation, but by a process akin to animal domestication. So that would be the kind of academic version of monogenesis, is that different skin colors, different potentially morphologies. Some monogenes were believed in more racial differences and were closer to polygenes, and some were, we might say, kind of skin deep monogenes. And then second, polygenesis, which has a really, it's a very interesting history because it has this very brief window of being the preeminent explanation of human origins in between kind of 1840 and 1859. That's in between, you know, when they become ascendant and when Darwin publishes On the Origin of the Species. And so polygenesis argues that each race was created for a different geographic location by God at the point of at the point of human or the origins of the world. And they argue that skull measuring, basically the cranial capacity, the internal capacity of a human skull, statistically collated, kind of correlates to these original five creations there. Those five, you know, racial groups are typically Native American, African, European, you might say East Asian, and Pacific Islander. And then groups like South Asians can kind of go in different categories in different periods. Same with Egyptians and North Africans. So people from kind of what you might think of the Middle East and Central Asia are sometimes included in Europeans and sometimes included in Asia. But polygenesis is really important because its core method is anatomical in nature, skull measuring, collecting of human remains. And the first half of the 19th century is often considered the anatomical era in medicine. So these two theories and way of understanding the body through anatomy create natural bedfellows in American medical education and even in the medicine of the Atlantic world.
Masters of Health argues that medical education in Northern and Southern medical schools was white supremacist, and that racist educational practices had roots in some of the country's oldest and most prestigious colleges of medicine. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what Northern and Southern medical education shared in common, and then how they differed. This is one of the more provocative claims of your book, of the book, I think. How similar they were.
Yeah, I guess I think I went in. I mean, the sad irony is I went in with this is a case where the archive really shaped the book. I went in with a different hypothesis. I was expecting similarity, certainly, but not nearly as much as was the case. So I think where we see similarities, first, both schools relied on stolen bodies and disproportionately black bodies, or the bodies of black people, I should say. And there are differences in this case where in a place like Boston, the black population was simply not large enough to have a preponderance of Harvard's anatomical material come from black people. And I think we most likely would have to say the same thing about Philadelphia and even New York City, even though they had larger African-American populations. But both stole black bodies and black people's bodies. And we know that they were to a disproportionate degree in the North. And likewise, that they all, you know, kind of viewed body snatching as defined through a social ladder. So you attack or prey on the poorest, weakest people in society, which is always black people, but then moving up to in somewhere like New York and Philadelphia, Irish immigrants, poor whites who end up in the poorhouse. So where they differed was not so much in ideology, but in practicality, is that Southern schools had a massive enslaved population. They literally, like the Medical University of South, or what's now the Medical University of South Carolina and previously the Medical College of South Carolina, literally bragged about using enslaved people for anatomical material, saying it was the most affordable dissection program in the country. Whereas Northern schools could not, just simply as a matter of practical life, could not do that. So that's one difference and similarity. They both shared a preponderance for measuring skulls, for teaching students a basically polygenesis way of seeing the body and seeing racial difference. They both displayed human remains and racialized human remains in their museums. And they both compared black people to animals in their curriculum and in their writing. So a figure like John Collins Warren, the professor of anatomy at Harvard through much of the antebellum era, we know through correspondence, actually discussing his lectures, that he said that people of African descent, they had longer arms like apes, for example, And this was definitely an idea that one can see in Southern racial science and to some extent in Southern medical education. Northern schools also at the University of Pennsylvania, we have some evidence they taught practical ideas about slave management for physicians. So how to check for an enslaved person potentially feigning illness. Just as often, we should say, enslaved people were not actually feigning illness, but paranoid enslavers were so afraid that they might lose a little money that they would kind of interrogate and potentially abuse, beat, and whip them to see if they were ill. And this was taught as a normal practice at at least some Northern medical schools and Southern medical schools. And one other kind of final difference, I've mentioned a few experiments on enslaved people's bodies. This is something where it's, once again, it's not so much that we don't know whether or not Northern schools would have condoned this or not, but they did not have access to enslaved people overall. So Southern schools, I found two cases where students conducted life-threatening experiments on enslaved people. And in Northern schools, I never found such a case, but that is quite different because enslaved people versus free Black people in the North, enslaved people don't have legal rights. They can't go to take a medical student to courts. And so there are greater repercussions in the North. And so you are actually having to navigate a social plane where people of African descent, while they're certainly heavily subordinated, most subordinated, probably underclass in the region, they do have some legal rights. And so there were some limits in Northern schools, what you could do versus Southern schools, or what a physician could do, I should say.
Sure. Thank you. It's, not easy reading. I wondered if you could, you write about how human remains, such as medical school skull collections, were used to advance racial science and medical education. And one of the things you do really skillfully as a historian is to take some examples of these medical remains and then give us the full human story of the people behind them. And I wondered if you could give us just a little bit of a flavor of that. If you could tell us about one of those examples you provide. My suggestion was maybe an African man named Sturman, but you can choose. Tell us about the human beings behind the sort of artifacts that are housed in these medical schools collections.
And I should say, it was very hard for me to write and very difficult for me to wrap my head around how to write this. And I was very lucky to work on this chapter at the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture. And my cohort of fellow scholars and the leadership there were really helpful because I found this at both kind of emotionally and intellectually, just it was going into a different realm from what I'm used to, which is, as you can probably tell from the interview, studying the letters and teachings of terrible white racist professors or very disturbing people. And Stormon was quite the opposite. He's exercising agency, but he's very much also in some ways a victim of this science, even as he is trying to constantly reshape his life. But Stormon was a teenager in Boston when he took his own life by hanging. But his whole story, I take us back to, as best we can tell from his childhood, he grew up in a place that the British Empire had, and the Dutch Empire, I should say, had disrupted for more than a century. And that's the Northern Cape of Southern Africa, what's now kind of area called Little Namaqualand, which is roughly the border of Namibia and South Africa. And Stormon's people, they were kind of Khoikhoi people, traditionally cattle herders, and had been displaced from their land during that previous century. And by the time he's growing up, they've kind of become hunters and gatherers. And he ends up as a teenager trekking from Western South Africa today to Eastern South Africa, where he meets a man who, invites him to come to Boston to make lots of money, quote unquote, paraphrasing, that's what is offered, to be in a P.T. Barnum exhibit. And this man makes a contract with the British colonial government in Natal, that's the city in South Africa. And Stormont is brought to the Aquarial Gardens in Boston. He has also even toured around the United States this is in 1860 and 1861. He's made to dress up and hold clubs and spears and sing songs and do the war and love dances, quote unquote. I mean, this is all in this promotional pamphlet. And in the local newspapers, there have this kind of try to make up for trafficking in Africans by claiming it's nothing like the slave trade, putting our kind of history hats on. Remember 1860, 61, this is the middle of the secession crisis. Massachusetts is supposed to be a kind of moral leader against slavery. And they are having these really disturbing human zoo-like exhibits in the aquarium. And at the end of it, Stormont hangs himself, and his story is told all over the newspapers. And his body is given to Harvard's medical school from the Aquarial Gardens. And, we should also note the Aquarial Gardens had given animal specimens, Aquarial Gardens being like an aquarium, animal specimens to Harvard's medical school. Harvard faculty, Jeffries Wyman, who ends up being the first, or is by this point the first curator of the what's now the Peabody Museum. He dissects Stormont. He writes a pamphlet comparing Stormont's body to apes. And they also create six casts of Stormont's head, which still exist and are at Harvard. And they also articulate his skeleton as a teaching tool, which, researchers at Harvard and myself were still trying to find, but have not had any luck. But I think what's so important of the story of Stormont and others like him is that both this science had a kind of society-wide disturbing effects of kind of promoting white supremacy, but it was also built on the remains of everyday people around the world who were already found their lives disrupted by the kind of white supremacist forces of colonialism, imperialism, slavery. Their lives were already disrupted, and then in their kind of final resting place ended up being in a medical school, not in their ancestral lands, not buried as they would have wished. We were pretty confident Stormont had some sort of spiritual beliefs. And it's also worth noting that in some African religions, suicide was not seen as an immoral act. So what we see is both the kind of macro and the micro scale in Stormont of a global system of violence, a scientific ideology that built to justify it, and that this was also just intimately built on human misery in a very tragic way.
Thanks, Chris. Yeah, it's this section. I thank you for sharing that about the Schomburg Center, because I was really in awe of how you managed to tell this history in a way that honors and centers the people who you're writing about. This brings me to the conclusion of the book, which is, I'm just going to quote it here. You conclude that Masters of Health doesn't relate an optimistic story, and there may be little reason to assume that the future of racism and medical education will be very different or better than the past. However, taken at face value, this book does provide a potential blueprint for change. So this is an upbeat ending. Tell us how can this book provide a blueprint for change, Chris, after so many years of injustice and exploitation?
Well, I think people might find my blueprint for change is a little bit depressing also, but the book is at its core a story of a small cohort of people. We're looking at initially, six faculty members at the University of Pennsylvania, seven at Columbia. a small cohort of people who built institutions, medical schools that rapidly proliferated across the country. And really in this first century, we're saying fairly low capital intensive. These are not the medical schools of the 20th century, that created, built, and instructed tens of thousands of people in an ideology that fundamentally shaped American life and politics. Now, that ideology, in my opinion, and I think my book well illustrates, is a grotesque and disturbing one. But it, you know, the core point is it's the institutions. We need to build institutions, reform institutions that shape the ideology and culture and politics of this country. And that is exactly what the polygenists did. That is exactly what the initial founders of medical schools did, is they built institutions, made them a valuable cornerstone of our country, of our politics, of our healthcare. And in this way, now that it's not an easy blueprint, in this way, if one wants to create a better world, I advocate at the end of the book for, you know, what does racism do? It says there are a separate class of people whose bodies are inferior, and that their bodies are the cause of their own ill health. So it justifies having two-tiered healthcare systems, justifies having unequal health outcomes. So on the one hand, I say we need to create institutions that push back and against racialization. And second, we need to address the underlying factors that cause inequality and that is then used to re-bolster these racial ideas. So, and for me, that is, you know, at least at the tip of the spear, the first thing is universal healthcare, universal, not just universal access, but affordable, free, universal, free at the point of service, universal healthcare, to both take away the kind of, on the one hand, we need to take away the justification for difference, for inequality. And second, we need to address the inequality itself. And that can only be done, and it's not just from people working inside institutions, but that can only be done through reforming these incredibly powerful, incredibly influential institutions like medical schools.
Well, thank you, Chris. That brings me to our traditional final question, which is, after more than a decade working on this project, what is next for you? What are you working on next?
I don't, would it surprise you if I said more of this? I couldn't leave this history behind. So when I started, found the kind of story of Stormon, and started really studying Harvard Medical School, the Warren Anatomical Museum, I knew let's hope not, but if this is the only book I ever write, I want this to get out. And it has to be there to really humanize a story of kind of the inhumanity of certain people. But I also knew there was a lot bigger story there. Stormont is not the only name in Harvard, the Warren Anatomical Museum's records. It's not the only, South Africa is not the only kind of imperial nation or enslaver society that's sending human remains to Harvard's medical school. So my next project is a global history of the Warren Anatomical Museum at Harvard Medical School through a series, and I think at different times I go back and forth, of five or six micro histories that of people like Stormon, and one of them will be a more drawn out history and a more depthful history of Stormon himself. And the real goal of that project is to blend the intimate with global political economy of kind of empire, enslavement, and kind of global emergent global capitalism, and how that shaped people like Stormon's lives, brought their skulls to places like Boston, and once again bolstered these white supremacist ideologies. So in a lot of ways, this second project is the mirror image of the first one, where Masters of Health is all about the medical school, all about training in the metropole, or the various metropoles of medical education. This is about going into the sites of life for people whose skulls were collected, the conflicts that shaped how they got to Harvard Medical School, whether they were killed in their own lands or took their lives in outside, far away from their home, like Stormon did. So very much trying to continue to bring humanity to the story, but also draw to the forefront an international set of forces that shaped American racial science.
Well, that sounds like a wonderful project and a great thing to be coming out of this work, which is sure to be a classic. You can tell reading it. It should be required reading in every medical school in the country. Thank you, Chris, for coming and sharing your work with us today on the New Books Network. We really appreciate the chance to talk to you.